from the classroom to the emergency room, OR and beyond. You're joining Trauma ICU Rounds with your host, Dr. Dennis Kim.
Welcome back to Trauma ICU Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Dennis Kim. Before we jump into today's rounds, I wanted to take just a moment to say thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. You know, it's really amazing to think that the show was launched only 10 months ago in April of last year. And just last week, we surpassed the 100,000th download of the show, which I think should be some kind of a milestone. Anyways, I wanted to send a huge shout out and thanks to all of our guest professors and of course you, the listener, for making this show such a success and so much fun to do. I really, really appreciate all of your support, kind words of appreciation, and comments on social media, at iTunes, and via email. So please do let us know what topics, articles, or controversies you'd like us to explore and discuss. You can reach me at traumaicurounds@gmail.com, via the website traumaicurounds.com, or via Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at, you guessed it, traumaicurounds. So joining me on rounds today is an individual who really needs no introduction, as he's really the godfather, at least in my eyes, of FOMED and EM Critical Care podcast, or in fact, medical podcasts in general, and that is a one Dr. Scott Weingart of MCRIT. Back in December, Scott was gracious enough to have me on his show, in which we discussed some pearls, pitfalls, and the how I do it of resuscitative thoracotomy. And today, we are discussing an equally high stakes, yet much less common emergent procedure, and that is surgical cricothyroidotomy, aka cricothyrotomy, or simply crikes. Now, this is a topic that we've previously addressed on Rounds back in episode 23, so if you haven't checked out that episode, please do so. Also, be sure to check out episodes 24 and 131 of MCRIT. The show notes will have links to the episodes, which have some fantastic content, including videos, review articles, and even plans for 3D printing, your very own models to practice on. So without further ado, Dr. Scott Weingart.
How the hell are you, brother?
I am good, man. I am pretty pumped for today's episode. Today, we are talking all things crikes.
Yes, we are. It's my particular area of interest.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed based on the number of posts, blogs, vlogs, and videos that you've put out over the years on this very topic. And I got to say that you've got some fantastic content at the MCRIT website. Now, Scott, this is one of those extremely rare yet high-stakes procedures that we might be called upon to perform. And so when you're talking to people about how to prepare or how to do a cricothyrotomy or cricothyroidotomy, what are some ways that we can be prepared for when the actual time comes for us to do it?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'm going to make some controversial statements because I'd listened to your crike episode. Uh-oh. And you said everything exactly as I would have imagined a trauma surgeon would say it. And that is my major contention. And I will put this forth at the beginning and then I will break it down such that it doesn't sound as horrible as it is. But there is no worse person to learn cricothyrotomy from than a trauma surgeon. And I will explain why that is. And you know my love of trauma surgeons. They are my brethren. I love you guys and gals, but you have no idea how to teach crike, and I will explain why.
Yeah, so take me back, man. So obviously, this is a procedure that many surgeons, EM physicians, will go their entire career and never have to perform. And for me personally, this is one of those procedures that, I don't know, it's like cardiac injuries and SFA injuries. They just kind of gravitate towards me. Mm. And, you know, having done about 14, just over a dozen of these things, I've never used a bougie. And so I want to hear from you, Scott, how did you go from doing surgical crikes? And then I'm looking here at a post and it says open cricothyrotomy for historical purposes only. What happened?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. You know, I don't know if I've said this stuff on the air or only in courses, but I've done a lot of cricothrotomies and like far too many. And, you know, I was actually asked, well, doesn't that just mean you're really bad at airway? And it's a fair question. So I need to disambiguate this. There was a time and a place, and I'm not going to say where or when, but there was a time and a place in my medical career where every patient who came in with asystolic cardiac arrest, who EMS did not intubate, got a cricothrotomy.
Wow.
And so we were exposed, this small cadre of people that thought this was a good idea, to an enormous number of opportunities that do not exist. And far more importantly, the stakes were low.
Right.
This was at the point where these patients should probably have been called already, because in the place this was, they would be in the field for 45 minutes, an hour before they came to you. And I think there is very, you know, possible ethical arguments you can make against this. And I think there's ethical counter arguments as well. But for whatever reason, this was considered okay for a period of time. And as a result, I got an enormous body of experience at this procedure in a situation at which the mental things that are going on for most people's cricothorotomy weren't. And that's a unique learning experience, because most people, their first crike is a crike that if they don't get it, the patient will die. And that adds a level of mental problematics that is really difficult to overcome. So that was my initial experience, and that's where a lion's share have come. But I think very similar to your experience, once you feel this is something doable that's in your repertoire, it's not that some magic gravitates to them. It's that you have far less compunction about just doing this as opposed to flailing around or trying other stuff than people that don't have this underneath their belt.
Absolutely. And, you know, we always talk about this cannot intubate, cannot ventilate / oxygenate. And there's so many guidelines put out by different societies, whether it's anesthesia, emergency medicine, head and neck even, and they kind of get complicated. You know, there's a lot of different steps and a lot of different things you can do to temporize LMAs, bougie-assisted intubations. But honestly, in the several cases that I've had to do this, the patients usually peri-arrest. And so it's not always happening in the ER. This may happen during a rapid response on the ward. We've had to do this in the hemodialysis unit one time. And so, yeah, you just got to be ready to make that cut. And I think similar to your training, so in San Diego, our trauma manual there, it was very clear when a patient needs to be intubated, it was always the either anesthesia or ER resident who got two shots, followed by the attending who was right at the head of the bed supervising. And if the attending couldn't get that on their third shot, then you as the trauma attending or fellow were expected to cut the neck and do a crike. And so our positioning was such that we were the ones, back when we used to give cricoid pressure, we were the ones holding cricoid pressure, and you're actually feeling the anatomy. You have a knife already in your pocket. And so if after that third strike, there's no definitive airway, you cut. Yep. And so we also got a lot of experience like that, but I think that's a little overkill.
Yeah, supraglottics can be the middle between that, but I don't think it's too far down the overkill pathway. Shock trauma published their airway experience, and they had the exact same thing you mentioned. Three attempts at laryngoscopy, then no more attempts allowed.
Right.
Supraglottic airway, in case for them it was an LMA. And if that failed, it was a crike. And their crike rate was 0.5% of all their airways, the sickest patients out there, which is a very reasonable rate of cricothorotomy. Sure. And their success rates for airway management were fantastic. And I think you can make it that simple. Three laryngoscopies, a supraglottic airway, and then a crike is the way it should be.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had this vast experience doing the surgical or open crikes. And so how is it that from circa 2011 forward, you've been advocating for the bougie assisted?
Yeah. So, you know, my evolution was I was first trained in a very meticulous method derived from ENT that was essentially involving a tracheal hook and a trousseau dilator and a lot of equipment that you would never have in a hemodialysis unit when a patient's dying in front of you. And that was the way all of our cracks were done. And it taught you a very good anatomical knowledge. You actually were feeling the cartilage to put the hook in. It was a good basis. And then I went to my trauma fellowship and they're like, what the frack are you doing? All you need is a scalpel. And they actually taught me the, you know, incision, put the back of the blade in, something I do not advocate.
Nor do
I. And then stick in the damn tube. And that was exactly how they taught you. They're like, you don't need equipment. You do this with a scalpel. That's the only thing you need. And so that was my next transition. And you realize you don't need any equipment. But, you know, and we're both too young for this, Dennis, but there was a time in the 70s where they didn't feel laryngoscopy was acceptable for trauma patients with cervical spine injuries or the thought that they might have. And all these patients got cracked. Right. And the cracks were all done by surgery. You know, we didn't really have a paradigm of trauma trained surgeons at that point, but there were surgical residents and attendings. And their anatomical knowledge was great. They got the right place most of the time, but there was still a very high failure rate. And the failure rate was for something you as a SICU doctor are very experienced in, which is just because there's a hole and just because you know the hole's in the right place does not mean the tube goes in the hole when you stick it through that skin incision. And that's really was the last failure mode that had to be fixed. And the fix came from the battlefield. And what they realized is with low visibility and under fraught, stressful circumstances, a lot of the time, even though the proper incision was placed and it was indeed into the trachea, that the tube did not go where you wanted it to go. And it's disastrous, potentially, if you get into the soft tissue of the neck and start ventilating, because then it fills up with air and it becomes a cluster. So the bougie, which came out of the battlefield when adapted to civilian medicine, was really, for me, a game changer. But still, the methods they were teaching were a blind placement of the bougie without confirmation. And the small addition I made to the technique was a finger got involved. So instead of scalpel bougie techniques, it was scalpel finger techniques, such that, first of all, the finger is the ideal dilator. It basically matches the size of a 6-0 ET or trach, which is what I use. But then also, since the bougie is riding the finger and the finger knows you're in the right place, the bougie can't be in the wrong place. And if the bougie's in the right place, the tube's in the right place. And this is really the game changer, is to eliminate that last failure mode of this procedure.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I do like that sort of revision or evolution, having that finger in the airway. And some of the best surgeons I've worked with who literally couldn't see, but they've got eyes on the tips of their fingers and they can feel the planes and they can feel the structures. But that is so critical. Getting your finger in the airway, it's an atraumatic dilator because it's blunt, it's soft, and then you can feel the rings. You know you're in the larynx or you know you're in the trachea.
Absolutely. I want to go back, if I could, Dennis, to why trauma surgeons are the worst people to learn crike from.
Oh, no.
And so the reason why, and I guess the best way I'll illustrate this is there was a study done in, I think it was the Korean War. It might have been Vietnamese incursions, but for dogfights, you know, in planes going head to head. And what they discovered is that if you survive 5 dogfights, you were basically indomitable. You could not be defeated. Your risk at that point after surviving 5 of getting shot down was so infinitesimally low. It's the same thing with cricothyrotomy. Mm-hmm. And when I hear a trauma surgeon saying, no, you know, you don't need any equipment, just use a knife. Or I hear a trauma surgeon, like you said, you know, in some circumstances, I'll do a vertical and then a horizontal. But in others, you know, if I can feel the anatomy, I'll do a horizontal. Yeah. They're absolutely right for them. And the difference is that they are performing in a mental state of composure. And this is the sine qua non of a trauma surgeon, is crap is hitting the fan and their mind is still working.
Right.
You know, should I do this or should I do that? What's going to happen if I go this way? And that is not how most people are going to experience their first or second or third cricothyrotomy. They will be in a monkey brain mode where they cannot think.
Right.
And as a result, they lose fine motor control and they lose the ability to have accurate judgments about the best way to proceed. And so when I hear a trauma surgeon like you say, well, if I can feel the anatomy, I'll make just a horizontal plunge incision, you're absolutely right for you.
Right.
And you had all these Twitter people, you know, bougie, you don't need a bougie. And I'm like, these are all trauma surgeons. And they were trauma surgeons. And they're absolutely right. Because even if you took a trauma surgeon that's only done 2 crikes, they've done retrocaval IVC injuries, you know, like they have built a mental structure that allows them to continue to have judgmental judgmental is the wrong word, good judgment in the face of a dying patient. And that is not the exposure that most people have of cricothyrotomy. So for those people, we need to find a way of teaching them and an advocacy of methodology that will succeed when their brain has shut down.
Yeah, those are fantastic points. And I think human factors is definitely something that we have to consider. And so in order to simplify it, when you make your incision, it's always a vertical incision to get through the skin sub-Q and let you feel that airway?
You know, it... There's what I teach and then what I do. And I'm very similar to you. I vary like my crike technique because, you know, I'm going to go by the individual circumstances. But what I teach is only one technique. And people can only train at one technique and they can only learn one technique until they've done enough, until they've been in those five dogfights. So what I teach is always make the vertical. And that way you're going to do it the same every single time because the vertical will always send you down the right direction. Is it going to be bloodier? Absolutely. That horizontal one cut thing is, it's beautiful. You don't even need a pad on the field because there's not going to be any bleeding. But it will fail on patients with non-palpable anatomy, and it doesn't fail well because it's not an extendable incision unless you tee it up. So it's not, from my mind, worth it for infrequent operators at this procedure. If you make a vertical incision and you realize I made it in the wrong place, no problem. And the lack of anatomy just means the cut gets bigger and bigger. And when you can't feel anything, patients with high BMI or patients with radiation therapy or what have you, the incision may very well be from the top of the neck all the way to the bottom. And that's fine because that's just a vertical incision. That's what you learn to do. And you just learn to keep making it bigger and bigger until each time you stick your finger in there and check, until you feel cartilage. And that's how you know your vertical incision portion of the procedure is done.
Yeah. I think, you know, the vertical incision, like you mentioned, that's a fundamental tenet of surgery, especially trauma surgery. When you make a cut or incision, doesn't matter if it's on the abdomen, the extremities, or the groin, you want it to be an extensile incision, something you can go up, something you can go down and make as long as you need to do. And just a few weeks ago, we had a patient morbidly obese, came in, they had an LMA down, he was oxygenating, but they literally had their fingers trying to make a seal in his oral cavity with the LMA, and he starts desaturating. We look at his neck, morbidly obese, and he's got a previous trach scar, and I'm trying to feel his cricothyroid membrane, can't feel anything. And so we make that vertical incision, and getting through that skin and subcutaneous tissue is critical. At that point, you can feel the anatomy.
Yep.
Then make your transverse incision. And you mentioned don't put the back of the blade in turn. Did you have a bad experience with that? Or did you just find
I've never cut myself, but I've seen people that have.
As
and
have I.
Again, when you have fine motor control, it's fine. You can do whatever you want. You know, you could take a pencil off the field and use that. Who cares? But when you don't, you're going to get cut. And your whole goal during this cricothyrotomy is to be able to use the blade twice and get it the hell off the field. Close down that safety latch and don't touch a blade from that point forward. So reversing that, when you have fine motor control, fine. You know, when your trauma surgery compatriots on Twitter mentioned that, I'm sure they have no problem with that whatsoever.
Sure.
Their hands are dead stable and it's not an issue. But if you're in monkey brain and your pulse is going 180, you know, my friend George Kovach, another Canadian, he talks about the psychological stress index, which is when your pulse rate is higher than the patient's.
That's
a bad scenario. You don't want to have the blade in your hand with the blade facing the meat of your palm. That's not a good way to play.
Yeah. And even just backing up, I guess. So we have a patient in front of us who it looks like we're heading towards a crike. In terms of the preparation, outside of maybe having your trach, and I personally prefer trachs if they're available, we'll go with the 6040ET tube, whatever, as long as it's got a cuff. But in the past, I used to always, you know, turn to some of the other providers and say, hey, get your iPhone lights on, and hey, let's get 2 yonk hours. It's going to be very bloody. And what I've done with my technique is I don't even ask for that anymore, because this has really just changed to a procedure based on palpation and feel. What's your approach in terms of preparation?
Well, you said two things in there that I think are worthy of comment. And the first one goes back to the fact that trauma surgeons are the worst people to learn crike from. And I'll give you a second reason. And again, you know, nothing but love for my trauma surgeon.
Of course.
You folks always, by nature of your job, will be performing the crike on someone else's failed airway. Now, think of the psychological thing that happens there too, is you're in rescue mode. And my anesthesiologist brothers and sisters feel the same way. You know, if they're coming to an airway, it's generally to rescue someone else's bad BVM ventilation or someone else's failed intubation attempt. There's no stress in that situation because if you succeed, you're a hero. And if you fail, then it was patient pathology's fault, not yours. Right. But the mental mindset, though, of the person who failed their own intubation, and failed is the wrong word. My buddy Rich Levitan has tried to change the language on this, but inevitable surgical airway is how he phrases it. When it's an inevitable surgical airway because of your own laryngoscopy attempts not being successful, it's a very different mindset. And, you know, it's usually, it feels good to perform a crike on some. I've had that opportunity. You know, I've gotten called in to help out and I've, done a crike to rescue someone else. It's an entirely different feeling than when you're one that failed on your own.
You know, I actually never thought about it that way, but you're absolutely right. I mean, we've got no skin in the game. We kind of show up, we saunter in with the cavalry here to help out. And if things go great, great. And if they don't, well, it's not our fault.
My most recent cricothoracotomy, and I feel pretty good about my airway skills. Sure. But it was an impossible laryngoscopy from my perspective, and supraglottic didn't oxygen in, and I criked the patient. It was a relatively easy cricothoracotomy, and it felt bad. Bad that I'd gotten to have to crank this patient. And so I called my anesthesia buddies and I said, do me a favor, intubate from above so I could get this crank out and then we could get hemostasis and it'll be nicer for the ICU folks not to have a crank in. And I let them try and they, the patient's saturating perfectly through my crank. So it's a whole different scenario. So even if they got it, it would have been different, but they couldn't get it. And only at that point did I let myself off the hook and say, it was an okay crike because, anesthesia couldn't intubate even in the best of circumstances. And only then did I say, okay, you're off the hook. It wasn't your failure as a laryngoscopist. So, there's definitely a different mental burden. But to get back to the original question, if you have any idea that you're going to get hemostasis and look into a field, then you've mentally prepared wrong for a cricothoracotomy because even in the best circumstances, it's a bloody mess. And now again, trauma surgeons are the worst people to look for because when you make a properly performed cricothoracotomy and see the amount of bleeding, it doesn't faze you at all because you're like, this is what superficial veins are supposed to bleed as.
For sure.
But when someone who is not in that milieu sees the bleeding that comes from a properly performed cricothoracotomy, it is scary.
Yeah.
Because, these superficial veins
bleed
like stink.
Yeah.
You think you've hit the innominate and it will definitely, again, have a very different mental result than it will for a trauma surgeon.
I've got to say the bleeding that comes when you punch through the cricothyroid membrane is always really impressive because it's literally spewing out at you now that air is finally moving.
Yep.
And yeah, people can be taken aback because they think they're doing something wrong when in fact they're doing exactly what they should be doing in that moment.
Absolutely. And one of the failure modes of this procedure is to try to get hemostasis.
Oh, for sure.
To see that enormous amount of bleeding, stop the procedure, try to get, direct prep.
Oh, no.
The key is, even if you hit the innominate, and this is the only, super dangerous thing you could hit in a midline properly placed incision is an aberrant course of an innominate. Even if you hit that, the move is still to finish the cricothoracotomy.
Absolutely.
And then it will respond to direct pressure, and then you could solve the problem. But the problem is never solved by trying to deal with the bleeding before an airway is put in. And most of the time, when you don't hit an innominate, the putting in the airway is a significant tamponade of the bleeding.
Oh,
so the solution is always, because if you leave it and you try to get Yankauers in there, they soil their airway and it becomes a real problematic thing, even if it's eventually a success.
Yeah, no, good point. And in fact, for all of these, like you mentioned, hemostasis, I think that's something you do once you're definitively in the airway, you've got your end tidal CO2. If you want to look for bilateral lung sliding, great, get a chest x-ray. But then those patients need to get hemorrhage control, and that's typically done in the operating room. So save that for later, focus on the airway. Now, you mentioned that you like using tracheostomies. And so let's say you don't have a tracheostomy. Any specific pitfalls when it comes to using an endotracheal tube?
Yeah. So when these crikes are done in my resus bays, we have 6-0 Portex cuffed trachs.
Nice.
And those are the only ones I will use. The Shileys, and I don't know, maybe you have more understanding of why this is the case. The Shileys outside diameter to their inside is dramatically different yeah. and they're much wider. And if all they hand me is a Shiley, I would just use an endotracheal tube. So we have 6.0 Portex. We have just the ones I want. And if I'm on the floor, there's an excellent chance that will bring me an uncuffed trach. And so I won't even ask for it. If I'm not in my resus bay, I will just ask for a 6.5 endotracheal tube. And the reason I choose that size is it will fit on every bougie currently manufactured. There's some bougies that are a little too thick for a 6.0. And then your next question, if I had to intuit it, is like, well, what if you don't have a bougie? Well, either you get bougies everywhere or you train without a bougie. Now, you know my prejudice is to use a bougie always, right. Which means if you're going to do that, you can't have a place in the hospital that doesn't have access to the bougie. So we have airway boxes in every code cart and every place in the hospital has a code cart and the bougie's there. So I know no matter where I'm going to have to perform a surgical airway, there will always be a scalpel because that's in our airway boxes all over the hospital and a bougie. And it took a long time to get that done. And I think there's probably follow-through benefits to airway management in general that an anesthesiologist will know anywhere they go, there's a bougie. It's a failure for laryngoscopy modality that I think should be everywhere. But that's the only way it's acceptable. Unless, you know, you tell me your surgical brethren carry scalpels in their pocket. Well, if you know, you don't have this across your entire hospital, then you got to carry a bougie with you as well. Most people aren't going to do that. So it's just easier to put it in the code box. If you don't have that, then you're going to be in circumstances where you have to perform this without a bougie. Well, then you should train without the bougie because you need to train such that there is one technique that will prevail no matter where you are in your individual hospital.
Agreed. I think from both a systems as well as provider standpoint, standardization is really critical, especially given the fact that you might be performing this procedure in any part of the hospital. Here at Harbor, anytime there's a need for an inpatient intubation, we activate our airway management team and anesthesia as well as EM alternate days in terms of who's most responsible. And in their airway kit, they always have a bougie on hand. So Scott, now that we've let's just say we've got the Kriken. In terms of aftercare, we've already talked about bleeding and hemostasis. Now, do you just leave the Kriken as it is, or do you typically convert this to a trach? And you mentioned earlier the potential for maybe just intubating from above and getting the Kriken out.
You did such a great job on this on your podcast on this, but it's a myth that Krikes have to come out right away. And it's a myth still prevalent in medicine. And it's funny how the myth happened. What was called cricothyrotomy in the days that, you know, these first publications were put out were not between the thyroid and cricoid. Right. It was actually between the cricoid and the first tracheal ring, which is a horrible place from the subglottic stenosis perspective. So, you know, of course, that's going to look bad in the subsequent results. And you can't conflate what we're doing. So, you know, anything that you think they're going to be intubated less than a week, just leave the cric. And that's our ENTs in our hospitals feeling as well. So it's great. That being said, especially if it's an endotracheal tube sticking out of the neck, it's not fun to manage those in the ICU. If you put a trach in, it's not so bad. And, you know, you might as well leave that if it's a big problem. But I find once the pressure is off and, you know, you could suction out the GI bleeding out of the mouth and the patient now has a stable airway, that with a video bronchoscope or even a video laryngoscope, it's usually very easy to intubate these patients from above. You have all the time in the world. My method for dealing with this is we'll make this as easy as possible. Let's pretend I was using a video laryngoscope. I will get a view of the glottis and I will actually deflate the cuff of the cric and put the bougie past the cric. Mm. So now I have a bougie in from above and then I'll have them reinflate the cric and give a few more breaths just to keep that patient's oxygenation up. And then I'll have them put a bougie through the cricothyrotomy as well. Mm-hmm. So now I have two bougies in the trachea. We'll remove the cric over the bougie, and then I will intubate from above. And only at that point, once that endotracheal tube is through the glottis, we'll take out that second bougie. Hmm. I like that. You could do the same thing with a video bronchoscope. It just substitutes for that, you know, through the mouth bougie. And with that method, almost every patient, I could just intubate from above. And now this is great because then either myself or my trauma surgery brothers and sisters or my ENT friends could come, open the incision, look for any bleeders that need to actually be tied off and just close it down and be done.
That's a great approach, Scott. And I've actually never thought about doing that. The only time I actually use a bougie in this setting is when I swap out the airway for, say, an armor tube, which is nice because it's really flexible. Yep, yep. You can kind of navigate the wound, get hemostasis. And so, yeah, the double bougie technique, something to definitely consider in the future.
But that clearly is for a patient that failed because they didn't have something that you wanted, actually, you know, front of neck access. You know, if you have a Ludwig's, I would say don't change it out for anything if you have hemostasis already. And just as you alluded to, the Crike will be fine for that, probably for the duration of their illness.
So we've talked about surgical Crikes. We've talked about bougie-assisted Crikes, needle Crikes. Is this something that you're ever teaching, Scott?
I don't, because the way people learn this and practice this is in one mind. And then when they actually need to do it to rescue a failed airway, it's in a completely different mind and a different degree of fine motor control, and it fails. And we have evidence for now this. Another Canadian, my buddy, Laura Duggan, she actually studied this, and these needle techniques in anger fail badly, even though they succeed in the lab. And it's just because what you need to do is such a fine motor action. Right. You know, keeping a wire from kinking as you attempt to dilate it is so fine motor, you will not succeed at this. So I don't teach it. But, you know, it's really nice to have for a person who is in the proper mindset. And it's funny, you know, one thing that's not discussed very much, though there are a few case reports, is doing a percutaneous trach in certain patient scenarios for an intensivist or a proceduralist or surgeon,
right,
is a very nice technique to have. And then you're just done. And these would be in patients who are awake and have upper airway pathologies, but they're still saturating well. And those needle techniques are wonderful, but they're not to rescue a hypoxemic patient as they're dying in front of you. You should just learn to use a knife, even if you're an anesthesiologist and this is not in your normal ballywick.
I almost think that somehow, because it's based on the Seldinger technique, maybe somehow from a technical and conceptual framework, it might be simpler for, let's say, the internist who is used to putting in Quintons and triple lumen catheters. You know, it's sort of the same setup, but I agree. I think if someone's got an acute surgical airway emergency, you've got to be ready to take out the knife and cut on the neck.
Well, that you've put your finger on it, Dennis, and this is the thing. Let's say that internist did feel more comfortable using these needle techniques, and let's say they got air return into their needle, into their syringe, you know, which is, you know, the first point of success for that technique, and they put a wire down. You need to make as big a cut as you would for your horizontal incision cricothyrotomy if you want it not to fail. And if they're willing to do that, it probably would be okay in many circumstances, because then there's not this enormous pressure of dilation because you're already made an incision big enough that it goes in like butter. But the reason they're doing the Seldinger is they're not willing to make that big scalpel incision that, I equate it very much to putting in, you know, a 13 French hemodialysis catheter. You know, if you're making like a dainty little, just the tip of your 11 blade incision, that's a real pain in the ass to dilate. You have to make a nice size incision. And I think the people that choose the needle-based approaches are the exact ones that are scared to wield that knife.
So getting back to the bougie-assisted Crike, Scott, I think I'm willing to give it a shot.
Yeah.
You know, we have the 3D printed task trainers that you have up on the website, and we teach during ATLS how to perform a surgical cricothyroidotomy, but we've never actually taught or practiced bougie assisted. So that might be a good opportunity to introduce it. I mean, certainly ATLS does tend to be a little bit behind. And the fact is, the vast majority of people taking the ATLS course aren't physicians. And so this might be a nice way to introduce them to a technique to perform cricothyroidotomy safely.
Yep. You know, one of my buddies, Sarah Gray, she has a monthly scheduled task on her calendar, and she takes out that 3D model. That's totally free, that people could print one of these out, and practices once a month and mentally simulates the environment she's going to be in and does it with her eyes closed such that it represents what it needs to be, which is a tactile procedure. And I think anyone who is intubating, or anyone who will be called to rescue a failed intubation, which includes certainly all of the people training in trauma surgery, emergency medicine, and anesthesia, should probably be practicing this from a mental and physical simulation perspective.
Yep. There's definitely no replacement for practice. And there are, you know, reasonable fidelity task trainers out there. And so I completely concur. I think this is something that we should be practicing, be familiar with. And it's not like performing a thoracotomy where there really aren't that many good, reasonable fidelity task trainers out there. And so with the airway emergency and the need to perform a cricothyroidotomy, it just seems like this is something that we should all have in our toolkit and be comfortable with, like you said, from both a cognitive as well as a technical standpoint. Scott, any other thoughts regarding cricothyroidotomy?
You know, I came from an institution that rewarded the successful performance of a cricothyroidotomy. And you know, if you got the job done and the patient didn't go into cardiac arrest, regardless of the circumstances, that was considered a win for that procedure. I mean, maybe what came before it might be problematic, but you never were shunned for a cricothyroidotomy. And I've been at other institutions where a cric hasn't been done in 10 years and they pride themselves on that, but they're not looking at the right rubric, which is how many patients have you had a cardiac arrest in the course of an intubation? And then when you ask them that, it's a whole different response. If you are at an institution where the performance of a cricothyroidotomy is looked at as a failure, then people won't perform cricothyroidotomies and many patients will die as a result. I look at any airway in which a successful cric is done as a absolute win. And kudos to all the providers. If this begins to be accepted as the normal course of events in, you know, very much like that shock trauma study, you know, 0.5%, that's probably right in that number. 1 in 100 to 1 in 200 emergency intubations is how this should be happening. So if you hadn't had a cric in 10 years, that's not something to be proud of at your institution. It means a lot of patients died who didn't need to.
Again, fabulous point, Scott. So listen, as we wrap things up, any final take-home points or key lessons that our listeners should take away from this particular episode?
Sure. So, you know, when I conceptualize this, the hardest part is getting people in the right mental mindset to perform the procedure. You got to just accept that this has to happen in some circumstances and be prepared for it and ready to do it. Second thing is, you might think you're going to learn 30 techniques, but if you are not a trauma surgeon, when it actually happens, you're only going to remember what you trained for, and you should only train with one technique that works in all circumstances. And you should not think you're ever going to see anything. It's going to be a bloody mess. So you're going to be performing blind once that initial incision's made. Get used to that idea. And then what the bougie adds is it fixes the final failure mode of this procedure, which is the tube goes where it wants to go. And if you could have a much smaller, more manipulatable device that could actually track along the pad of your finger, it's going to eliminate those last points of failure. If you want to hear more about this, just go to mcrit.org/cric, and I have videos of all the techniques we mentioned.
Yeah, those are some fantastic resources. And so please do check those out. Hey, Scott, man, I want to thank you, brother, for joining me on Trauma ICU Rounds.
Oh, what a pleasure to talk to you again, Dennis.
Yeah, always a pleasure, man. Always learning something from you. So keep up the fantastic work. For those of you out there that enjoy this episode, please make sure that you share it with your friends and colleagues and let us know that you like the show. Leave us a positive comment in iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast from. Until next time, please stay safe, continue reading, take care of yourselves and one another.